Chasing sound without Eric teasing us for our outfits as he walks around in his swanky jazz sweater
looking good,
poking fun at us for our pantsuit sort of things that we always wear on Monday. We like it. We think they're comfortable.
We look good.
We didn't even notice they were pink when we bought them. Good evening. This is Chasing Sound. We appreciate you tuning us in at KOOP.org, where we're streaming live right now, or listening to us on your fancy HD radio at KVRX HD3. However you're checking us out, might even be the rebroadcasts on Radio Free America, which always features the last couple of weeks' episodes for your favorite shows. However you're doing it, we appreciate it. Tonight, we got a special treat for you. It's all about the great producers. We're not going to cover every great producer that ever lived, because that would be a lot, but we're going to cover about six of them,
nice.
If we get to all of them. But it's going to be a good time. Before we get started on that, man, how was your Friday show?
It was good. Had my buddy Ben Weatherall come in and do backup.
Nice. Did they do, like, doo-wop harmonies? Or?
Yeah, he sang the story behind it.
Right. Very cool. Though, seriously, though, was it keyboard? Or?
No, he had a guitar and he had some loops.
Very cool. Okay, man after my own heart.
That's right.
That's my favorite improv rig is a looper, maybe a drum machine if you're feeling nasty, Miss Jackson, if you're feeling nasty. So cool. What was the name of the story you did?
Exhalation by Ted Chiang.
Very nice. So yeah, if you don't know about that show, my man's show is every Friday night, 8 o'clock, the stopped clock.
That's right.
Yeah, so technically the show doesn't ever progress in time because the clock just stops.
It's at the same time, which is no time.
Yeah, he will regale you for an hour with a reading voice that will send chills down your spine. It's great. I don't know why you don't do commercials for a living. You should be a millionaire living on an island somewhere doing commercials for toothpaste, being rich. So we are going to kick it off tonight with a story about a guy who I don't think, in my opinion, doesn't get enough credit in music history. He's a genius guitar player. You know, this is all by my estimation, a genius songwriter. He's written some of my favorite songs as far as Americana stuff. He did this one great song called My Horse is Sweating, which is about a true story about a 14-year-old who fought for the South in the Civil War, and when the Yankee soldiers came over a hill, he ran for his life, and they hanged him for treason. So Rundgren wrote this great song about how the kid's 14-year-old sitting on his horse with a noose around his neck, composing a letter to his mom in his head, And the punchline of the story is my horse is sweating, like the horse is wondering, like, what is about to happen? Just this gorgeous song, and it's, God, you just never hear anybody talking about this guy's song. So Rundgren quickly realized when he was, maybe a quarter of a way into his career, that he could make a lot more money as a record producer. And this is during the heyday when producers made a huge amount of cash for producing a good record. And so he started splitting his focus or doing an awful lot more record producing. And he was good at it. He got the right sound. He met his schedule. He met his budget. He was just a guy you wanted in your pocket if you needed something done well as far as production. Let's turn our attention to the British band XTC. If you don't know XTC, I certainly don't have time to go over their career for you, but let's just say XTC had been a very promising and relatively popular band, and then all of a sudden in, let's say, 83, 84, they had hit this slump where their last couple of records weren't selling. The leader of the band, the main creative force behind the band, Andy, he started having, what do you call it, agoraphobia, or basically just soul-shattering stage fright. He could not take the deck anymore. And so they just stopped touring. They stopped playing live at all. There were a couple of, like, I think they did one or two performances from the mid to late 80s, but they would do things like, if they played at MTV, they would have them clear the room, so they'd be playing for a camera guy, basically. Yeah. Basically, they just stopped touring. And so the problem with that is the records became the fund for Andy and his band, or mostly Andy. He basically, most bands, they make a good record and then they go out and they tour for, the whole cycle, make a record, tour, promote, everything is usually 2 or 3 years, depending on how big the record is. And a big chunk of that is just promotion and touring. An awful lot of it is touring to sort of sell the record. But if you don't have touring anymore, then the studio time becomes your only real fun, your only real time as a band. So XTC started pushing the studio time further and further. Instead of 6 months, they would take a year. Instead of a year, they would take a year and a half. They would, instead of spending a year to do the whole thing, they would spend a year just on mixing. It was just getting out of hand. And it started affecting the records too. It's something that you call, let's see if I can understand this correctly, psychoacoustics, where basically, and you make music, whenever you make a track, the more time you spend on it and the more overdub tracks you put on it, the more you start to sort of mess with the sonic space. Yeah. And eventually you will exhaust your listener, even though intellectually they can't tell you what's wrong. They just know instinctively something is wrong.
Yeah, it's too busy.
Right? Or... And that's, you think of the genius of the Beatles. If you ever get a track listing from a Beatles record that shows who played what on it, you start to realize some of the greatest songs in history that are considered genius productions, there were maybe only 5 instruments listed. You think of songs from Sgt. Pepper's and stuff like that, and you're like, oh, it's just this world of music. It's like, no, it's maybe 5 or 6 things happening at the most in a simple 2-part harmony, and it just sounds like World War III. It isn't necessarily. So XTC started making these records that were too dense, or at least by some people's measure. And the record company was getting tired of it. They were going over budget, over time in the studio, and producing weaker results, stuff that was less and less compelling to their fan base. And so who did they call in? The straight to the point, pulls no punches, Todd Rundgren. And they call him in America, and they're like, hey, we want to ship XTC over to you. You've got this reputation. Can you just put this band in line and get them to just knock out a decent record with the money we've got to spend and the time we've got to give it? Can you just do that for us? He's like, yeah, no problem. Send those punks over to me. And so they get there, and there have been tons and tons of stories told about this. From the XTC camp and the Todd Rundgren camp. Basically, you have XTC saying, basically, Todd Rundgren brought them into the studio. He had the record company send all the demos over first, and then Todd Rundgren put together a coherent story. Not necessarily a concept album, but he felt in his heart that every record needs some sort of a concept to follow. You need a beginning, you need a middle, and you need an end, and you need to have a clear vision. So he took the demos, and he mixed them and to get, you know, halfway the sound he wanted, and he put them in a certain track order. And when the band got there, he's like, this is the record we're going to make. I've heard about you, Andy. I've heard about your reputation. You're not pulling any of that BS with me. We're getting to work, and this is the record we're going to make. And he would do things like, if they were, you know, if they didn't sing the song correctly, he would walk in and, you know, Rundgren's a great singer in his own right. So he would just kick open the door and be like, look, I'm going to lay down a scratch vocal and you just copy what I just did. This is what XTC said for years later. They'd say he was basically a slave driver and an abuser. And in Rundgren just said, I can't even say what he said about the band, but basically that they were weak and he definitely questioned their masculinity. But that's how it went. And he knocked it out in this record, to this day, most people's favorite XTC record. So he makes it, but the story didn't end there. When it was finished, the band went back to England and started doing press where they were saying, this is the worst record we've ever made. Todd Rundgren has ruined this band. And then not only that, there was one song that was a big standout to Rundgren. What Rundgren said, that's going to be your hit. And XTC had gotten in some trouble recently. Well, they'd been kicked off a project where they were producing this pop singer, this Irish pop singer's album, and she was a Catholic, and they made fun of her for being a Catholic, so they got fired from that job. So they were worried about having the song Dear God, which sort of questions the whole Judeo-Christian God and the meaning of it all, and they didn't want to get in trouble, so they pulled it off the record. Keep in mind, this record was mixed and mastered. Once you have a record mastered, you can't go pulling tracks off and putting other ones on there, but that's just what they did. They take off Dear God, and they put on this song Satellite, which had nothing to do with the rest of the album. It was just one of Andy's new songs that he had recorded during the session, and so they had to remaster it, which gave, you know, probably the first however many hundreds of thousands of copies of this record were made were out of phase, because when they remastered it, it sort of messed with the original mastering. It's a very weird story. So they released the record. They told Rundgren what happened, and he's like, what? You took off the hit? Are you crazy? So when they finally released the record, they start sending out a single. And the first single was this song called Grass, which is a really cool song. On the B side, they needed to unload this unused song, Dear God. So it goes out to all the DJs, mostly college DJs around the world, and some even more like top 40 focused people in Europe where they were a little bit bigger. And within a minute, all these DJs flip the record over and like, oh, what's this? They play Dear God. And they're like, forget Grass. And they just started playing Dear God. Dear God was a B-side, but it became the hit. It became college rock gold, basically. It was everyone's favorite song. No one could shut up about it. In fact, it was such a big hit that the record company was like, you're going to put Dear God back on the record and remaster it again. And of course, Rundgren's in America just laughing his butt off, like, you idiots. I told you that was your hit. What were you even thinking about that? So they re-released the album, you know, probably had 100,000 or 200,000 already pressed out there with a slight out of phase issue. So they put Dear God back on there. And this goes on to become, I don't know if it's sold more than any XTC album, but if you only have one XTC album, the Skylarking is going to be the one. It's just the one that stood out, and it was just powerful. And decades later, the guys in XTC finally admitted, like, we do have Rundgren to thank for sort of our place in musical history, because everyone seems to love and know that record. And if you only know one XTC song, Dear God is probably going to be the one. If you only have one album, Skylarking is probably going to be the one. But to this day, Rundgren just loves teasing this band. He was on Mark Maron's podcast recently, and just, I waited all the way to the end of that podcast for him to talk about XTC, and I was not disappointed. The last 5 minutes of the podcast, he just ripped into them. Not, you know, just the leader mostly. I think he liked the rest of the band. But yeah, just their self-sabotage, the whole thing of where they were obsessing over making records and forgetting at some point someone has to listen to this. You know, and not to take sides in this, because these songs were created by XTC, you know, producer notwithstanding. They did make this incredible batch of songs. So we're going to kick it off tonight with Dear God from XTC's Skylarking album, which came out in 1986, I believe. And this begins our story of the great producers. Here we go. Hang on, let me just get my stuff fired up here. Got all excited, forgot to turn everything on. All right, here we go. Enjoy.
letter, and I pray you can make it better down here. I don't mean a big reduction in the price of beer, but all the people that you made in your image, see them starving on their feet, 'cause they don't get enough to eat from God. Can't believe in you.
Dear God, sorry to disturb you, but I feel that I should be heard loud and clear. We all need a big reduction in amount of tears. All the people that you made in your image sit on fighting in the street, 'cause they can't make opinions meet. You're
Did you know all of Co-op's programs are now archived and available online 24/7 at Radio Free America? All of Co-op's great programs are yours to enjoy up to 2 weeks after a program is aired. Visit our website at koop.org to find out how you can hear your favorite show on your schedule. It's your community radio station, KOOP at your fingertips, thanks to Co-op and Radio Free America.
Support comes from Spokesman, serving coffee made with a variety of house-roasted beans, a rotation of craft beers, ciders, kombucha, and wines. Located in the yard on East St. Elmo Road, Spokesman offers an indoor bike rack for ride-up customers, an outdoor patio for pets, and a place to settle in with a laptop. Open until 11 p.m. Monday to Thursday, midnight Friday and Saturday, and 10 p.m. on Sunday. Information about events and online ordering at spokesmancoffee.com.
Kombucha and coffee. What else do you need, really? Thanks for hanging in there. Welcome back to Chasing Sound. Right before the break there, we had a very important track in the zeitgeist of recording history, let's say for the past 100 years. I don't know if there's a track more important than Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. That came out on their Revolver album, which was released in 1966. So just to give you some perspective, it is the final track in the running order on the album, but Tomorrow Never Knows was actually the first song the Beatles recorded in that session for Revolver. That recording session kicked off, I think, roughly around April 14th of 1966. If you think about that, that's crazy. It's really before the whole Summer of Love happening in San Francisco. Really before the 60s as we know it had truly kicked off. It was showing some signs. You had some things happening. You had Bob Dylan happening, the Beatles, the Byrds had their, a big hit song with using 12-string guitar and a kind of a trippy sound. But what we know is the 60s had not yet begun in full swing, and the Beatles were messing with some compelling stuff. Paul McCartney had become obsessed with some German guy who was doing a lot of stuff with tape loops. That's why you hear in that track, that's Paul McCartney working, fast forwarding and rewinding tape loops to give that weird sound. You have George Martin at his best as far as challenging the band. It's a sort of a nod to Indian style music where it's just one note. It's basically the note of C and they're just rolling over it. And it took a while. I think Ringo had to mess with the beat for a long time because no rock group had really ever done that, basing everything on a drone and having the one be all there is. There's no one in the three or anything like that. It's just the note C. So he came up with that awesome rolling drum beat that's which unbelievable, unheard of in rock history. So it was one of the most challenging songs the Beatles had ever messed with, and one of the most challenging things George Martin ever messed with. And as far as great producers, it doesn't get better than George Martin. And to think that guy, look at it realistically. When the Beatles sold 1 million records, George Martin didn't make a cut of that. George Martin probably made $87 a week take home from the record label. He was just a producer. He was a guy no different than a clerk at a grocery store. He just had a job and probably had a very humble flat and a very humble car, if a car at all. You know what I mean? Most likely the guy took the bus down to the studio or walked. He was never, at least not at that time, a tremendously wealthy man. He was very much a blue-collar sound engineer. It just so happened that he lined up perfectly with the Beatles. He saw what they were going for, and he sort of grew with them. And Revolver marks the point where the Beatles had said, we're not touring anymore. The studio is going to be our performance. That's going to encapsulate everything we have. So to give you a little history on this track, it was initially titled Mark One. I'm not sure why, but that was what they were calling it. And it was, like I said, extremely challenging. The rhythm track is the simple single note, but trying to make a groove over a single note presented a lot of problems that they were finally able to overcome. If you listen to the shift on the vocals, at about the 1 minute mark, John Lennon's vocal sounds really distant and raw, and it's being pumped through the speaker inside of a Hammond organ. And it's giving it this kind of swirly, almost distant sound. And the vocal changes here and there. It's got intricate use of feedback. in little places here and there, which was way ahead of its time as far as using feedback as an instrument in a song. And it's it was just completely new. It blew everyone away. And honestly, I think people to this day are still trying to catch up with what that song sounded like. The way they used overdubs in that song, it was just... The Beach Boys and the Beatles were these first groups that said the studio is its own instrument. The producer is as big a part of the band as your lead guitar player or your lead vocalist. And they explored this idea. And we'll get it, you know, more on the Beach Boys later in the show. But to me, that song represents everything that is great about approaching the studio in a way that is utterly musical, not just a box where you go and set up your smaller boxes and record a band. There's a lot more that you can do with that. And if you think about this, I don't even know that they had four-track technology. Like, England was way behind. We were using a lot of multi-tracking already in the States. But in England, they were still recovering from World War II. So I think they were still, you know, they were still ping-ponging between two-track and not even really getting into some of the exciting stuff that we already had over here in the States and our different studios. So they were really getting it done with some... small, like if you ever complain about what you got for your home recording setup, just think of George Martin having two tracks to work with and then ping-ponging them back and forth. Yeah, and if you know anything about that, once you ping-pong something, there's no going back and changing it. Like you're locked into that. If you've ever messed with four tracks and tried to get 12 tracks out of that, it's an arduous process. Eats up a lot of your time. So enough on that, though. Those first two songs, Dear God and Tomorrow Never Knows, really set the tone for what we're going for tonight here at Chasing Sound. Thanks for hanging out with us at koop.org, streaming us live right now. The next producer we're going to get into is Steve Albini. He did a record in 1988 for a little group called the Pixies, and at this time, he was... what you would say, green. I think he'd done a couple of records, but he was not a well-known producer, just known enough to get the gig, probably. So Surferosa was one of the first records that he did, and I grabbed a couple of quotes here that I think are interesting. So he says, Surferosa was one of the first records I worked on where I didn't know anybody involved before we got started. So basically it was dumped in his lap. He knew nothing about this band. He says, I was fairly green and I felt slightly overambitious and started installing my own personality into the record. So if you're familiar with Surferosa, there's no dead air between songs. The songs butt right into each other. And Steve Albini recorded the band talking in between takes and used little slices of their talking to bridge songs together, which he years later would apologize for. He thought it wasn't his place to do that. And this band was so young, they didn't know how to tell him no. So I think he felt like he overreached on that. But a lot of people feel like that's half the charm of that record. He later said it was kind of gimmicky, and he was a little bit hung up on that at the time. He thought it was old-fashioned sounding to have 2-3 seconds of dead air in between songs. And he sort of later learned his lesson and now suspends his own taste and personality when he records bands. One of my favorite things about this scenario, though, is that Albini was not a huge Pixies fan.
No, really.
And for years after, and it blew up and everyone started looking to Albini, you know, after that, who worked with Albini? PJ Harvey, Nirvana, they were all wanting to record with him to get that Surferosa sound. And he didn't think they were that good of a band. He was, you could read quotes of his in the early 90s saying that they were mildly entertaining college rock. For a couple of years there, he denied having produced the album. And he honestly said he thought that the only things he liked about the Pixies were he thought Dave Loverling was an excellent drummer. He thought they were well rehearsed. And he thought the bass player, Kim Deal, was amazing. His one song that he liked off the record was Gigantic, a song that Kim wrote and sang. And he felt that her personality was the best part of the band. And he later went on to produce The Breeders and... you know, to this day, he's a huge fan of Kim Deal. But he, you know, even recently I heard an interview with him where the guy was like, oh, can you talk about the Pixies? He's like, they were fine. He just wasn't that into him. But it's interesting. He did a lot of cool things recording that album. Like, he had the guitar players use metal picks to get an even heavier sound. Yep. He was putting guitars into these sort of locker rooms to get this intense echo and just, as far as guitar tone, Surferosa is a very heavy record. And, you know, what his own opinion is notwithstanding. If you're a Pixies fan, That's the one. That's the one that just grabs you by the ears and doesn't let you go till it's over. It's just raw. It's powerful. The songs are all like less than 2 minutes long. And it's just a killer record. And Albini brought some incredible ideas to the table. And he made a sound. The Pixies never sounded that way again, either before or after Surfer Rosa. They never quite sounded that way again. But there were tons of artists that came to America from England specifically because they wanted that Albini sound, which they considered to be Surfer Rosa. So it definitely helped build his reputation, and he ended up doing records for multi-platinum artists, I think based on the strength of how much people were floored by the album Surfer Rosa. So without further ado, here's one of my favorites off that album. This is River Euphrates by the Pixies off the Surfer Rosa album.
I keep crawling back to you. The ranger came with burning eyes. The chambermaid awoke surprised. Thought she'd seen the last of him. She shook her head, let him in. Ooh, I keep crawling back to you. Ooh, I keep crawling back to you. Hey baby, there's something in your eyes trying to say to me that I'm gonna be alright if I believe in you. It's all I wanna do. Me and my sidekick. He was drunk and I was sick. We were caught up in a barroom fight till an Indian shot out the lights. I'm so tired of being tired. As sure as night will follow day. Most things I worry about never happen anyway. Ooh, I keep crawling back to you. Ooh, I keep crawling back to you.
Join me, Ted Branson, host of Under the X in Texas, every Tuesday, 9 to 11 a.m., for a journey through the history of Texas music from the early pioneers to new artists carrying on in their traditions, highlighted by in-studio live performances weekly on KOOP 91.7 FM, your community radio station.
Support comes from Cornucopia Popcorn, featuring Valentine-themed tins and seasonal flavors like chocolate-covered cherry, strawberry cheesecake, Red Hots, and Nutella Delight. There's even champagne pop, made with white chocolate and pop rocks. Pre-orders accepted online for pickup, in-store, or shipping nationwide at cornucopiapopcorn.com.
There's champagne popcorn that features pop rocks.
Sounds great.
Table for two, please. Thanks for hanging out. This is Chasing Sound. Tonight we're diving into the world of the great record producers. You're streaming us live at koop.org or listening on KVRX HD3 on your HD device or the rebroadcast at Radio Free America. However you're doing it, we appreciate your company tonight. Before the break there, we had Tom Petty off of his album Wildflowers. That was a song, Crawling Back to You. I think that song only ever got played live maybe three or four times. It was just one of those, it's kind of a weird one, and the band didn't get around to playing it live a lot. So if you ever saw that song live, that means you're a hardcore Tom Petty fan. Before that, we had the Pixies with River Euphrates, the Beatles with Tomorrow Never Knows, and XTC with Dear God. So getting back to Wildflowers, if you're a Tom Petty fan, then you know there's sort of this weird thing in his discography. You have the Heartbreakers records, which are incredible, what you would call singles records, where there'd be a batch of good songs with three or four killer songs that were the hits. They were made for radio, the Heartbreakers were. But occasionally Tom Petty would do a solo album where he wouldn't have the entire Heartbreakers band. He would use his, you know, he always had his main lead guitar player he had on every record, but he would use other musicians. The first one he did that was just under the name Tom Petty was Full Moon Fever. I'm sure you remember that one. It had Free Fallin', a lot of big hits for him, and might have been his best seller up to that date. It was just, there's something about it when he does a record outside of the Heartbreakers thing where he just goes, he cuts a little deeper. It's sort of like when Neil Young does a record without Crazy Horse. He just goes in a weirder direction and he gets a little bit more personal in an interesting way. So there are a lot of people that, you know, they like Tom Petty's singles on the radio, but as far as albums, they really only seem to like his that are just under his name and not under the Heartbreakers. So after Full Moon Fever, his next album that he did just under his name was Wildflowers. And at this point, Tom Petty was struggling. He was having a hard time finding his voice. He was sort of sick of the road he had been on and the path he had been on. The longtime drummer for the Heartbreakers at that point, who had been with them since the 70s, well up into the early 90s, had been kicked out of the band. Things weren't going well with him. And he was just, Tom Petty was sort of reaching. The record company was going to do a best of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. But at that time, and let's say like 93, 94, when bands were putting out best of albums, there was this little gimmick where the record company would have you record two or maybe one or two new songs and package that onto the greatest hits album, and then they would release one of the new songs as a lead single for the album. And Tom Petty hated this idea. He's like, how can it be a hit? How can it go on the greatest hits if I haven't written it yet?
Yeah.
Or if it hasn't been released yet. But so he finally caved because, you know, when you're under contract and all that, that's how that goes. So he reached out to Rick Rubin and he sort of confided in this, you know, the great producer, Rick Rubin, who we have to thank for a lot of the early New York hip hop. I mean, if you don't know Rick Rubin, he's recorded everything from LL Cool J's Going Back to Cali to Slayer, he's all over the map. He's a great, he did the Ghetto Boys, the first really good Ghetto Boys album he did, just extraordinary hip hop and some really interesting rock records too. He's all over the map as far as what he's done. Tom Petty reaches out to Rick Rubin. Fortunately for Tom, Rick Rubin was a huge fan. He had been obsessed with Full Moon Fever, had been like the only thing he listened to for like a year. He said he just, every time he got in the car, he put on Full Moon Fever. And so he tells Tom, he's like, well, just stop doing records that way. Let's get you into a studio and do something natural sounding. Let's use live recordings. We'll have the band rehearse, and then we'll play it live. And then instead of, you know, synthy stuff, we'll use much more organic sounding stuff, Mellotron, live strings. If you want a little orchestral stuff, don't use the synth. Let's get an orchestra in there. And they recorded the song Last Dance with Mary Jane, which was the lead single for the Best Of album. That Best Of album sold 10 million copies.
Yeah,
so Tom Petty, after it came out, he's like, well, what do I know? And after that song was cut with Rick Rubin and was such a huge hit and propelled this, what otherwise would have been just another greatest hits, into becoming, you know, 10 times platinum. When his next album came around, he's like, all right, Rick, you're with us now. Tom Petty had found this drummer, this older black dude from the UK who was just a killer drummer. So he had his confidence back. He had the right producer. He had the right drummer. And he starts writing songs, and he had written a ton, probably 30. And they go into the studio, and they start making Wildflowers. And I don't know how anybody else feels in the world, but to me, Wildflowers is one of the greatest achievements in American music history. And it's my all-time favorite Tom Petty record by a landslide. And I love Tom Petty. It's just one of the most powerful heartbreaking / heartwarming albums I think that's ever been made. And I dug around looking for some different quotes, and Rick Rubin had an interesting take on Wildflowers, because when they were going to put it out, Tom Petty wanted it to be a double album, but the company, the record company, was like, we don't really want to do that. So there actually was about 30 songs recorded. Only, I think, 14 or 15 made it onto the single album Wildflowers. Single CD. If it had been on vinyl, it would have had to have been double. But it was a single CD format. And some of the songs that were left over ended up on a soundtrack to kind of a small film called She's the One. Tom Petty did the soundtrack for. So a handful of them made it onto that. But there were still more. And there's been rumors, ever since I was in high school, there have been rumors that there would someday be a reissue of Wildflowers with all the missing tracks on it. Still to this day, it hasn't happened. It's crazy. Tom Petty was also talking about for years touring and playing just Wildflowers. But he never did. Of course, it's too late now. But I dug around, and apparently years after the fact, when they were, Rick Rubin was going back and listening to some of the outtakes and playing some of them for Tom Petty. He's like, wow, listen to some of these songs that we didn't end up putting on the album. And Tom Petty confided in Rick Rubin then, and this is a quote, hearsay, Tom Petty talking to Rick Rubin. This is what Rubin could remember. He said, he told me Wildflowers scares him because he's not really sure why it's as good as it is. He says that it haunted him, and it created a ghostly feeling for him. He said he loves it, but he knows that he can never do it again. Like, if you had a gun to his head, he couldn't make Wildflowers Part 2. He just is incapable of it. But that he was okay with it because that was sort of the point. He's like, I can't do this now. That was then. That's where I was at. That's where my headspace was. And it was a very prolific time. And it was sort of an extension of this moment in my life. You know, he was, I think, going through a divorce. And it's got some of the most gorgeous songs about telling your lover of many years who you're now breaking up with. Like, the song Wildflowers is about that. You belong in a field of wildflowers. You deserve to find love in your life. Just because we're not going to be together doesn't mean I don't care greatly about how your life plays out. And it's done in this way that's just so beautiful and sort of heartbreaking at the same time, when you realize that's how it is, man. Love burns away. Like, under the first harsh daylight of reality, when people are in different places, love fades at some point. Even if it's lasted for a decade or two, most of the time, statistically speaking, it goes away, or it changes in a way that can no longer be reconciled. And to me, Wildflowers captures that perfectly. It's just got this great punch to it, when these songs about sort of coming of age and people who look back on high school and felt like they were so confident, and now suddenly they find themselves with no confidence whatsoever. And lyrically, musically, it's just fantastic. So I played that track off of there, Crawling Back to You. I think it's maybe the second to last track on the album. It's sort of buried at the end of it, but I love that song. So beautiful. Continuing on with our evening dedicated to the great producers. Next thing we're going to get into is the Beach Boys. So this song, Good Vibrations, was, when you look at the Beatles, Tomorrow Never Knows, that was unprecedented, and Good Vibrations would be the other side of that coin, the American side of that coin, where a group started using a studio as a weapon, started using it as an instrument that was every bit as important as the individual musicians, if not more so. So they recorded, all in all, over 90 hours of material for this. If anyone's ever researched Good Vibrations, it's bizarre. There's basically 10 hours of, you know, the cello part that's like da 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 da. There's 10 hours of that trying to get that right. And I'm doing the quotes here because that's where Brian Wilson was at. When you're trying to get it right and you're Brian Wilson, apparently it can take a very, very long time. So they were in the studio. They ended up spending an unheard of amount of money. I think probably $200,000, which is like the saying today that somebody spent $10 million on a song. Unbelievable. Luckily for them, it was one of the biggest hits the Beach Boys ever had, so it made its money back. But this was at the point where Paul McCartney and Brian Wilson were sort of competing with each other. You have Rubber Soul, which inspired Pet Sounds, which inspired Sgt. Pepper. They were sort of back and forth because the playing field, there was no one else touching them. So they had no one but each other to compete with. Basically, Brian Wilson had the Beatles and George Martin to sort of try and one up, and vice versa, because nobody else was even close. Not even close. It's like they were playing a different sport. So this song, Good Vibrations, is so unique. There's a million aspects of it that I don't even have time to get into. But the most interesting part for me is that it's got all these cut and paste. So, you know, a minute into the song, it drops out and in a totally different tempo, totally different feel and vibe just comes in. And you're like, gotta keep those good vibes, right? It's not even the same style for a minute there, and then it'll switch to something else. And it's the first time anyone had ever heard anything like that, where you just stop on a dime and start playing almost a totally different song, but it's the same song, and you somehow don't lose the momentum that keeps your listener interested. It's so insane what they pulled off on that song. It features the theremin, a great instrument. If you don't know about it, I don't have time to explain it, but the guy who invented it, I'm obsessed with him, Leon Theremin. It's basically, you know, think of the sound of sci-fi music or old horror movies, that sort of weird whistling, swoopy sound. And it's a instrument that's controlled by the movement and flow and the vibrations of your hands. So it fits perfectly for this track. And this song is just one of the weirdest things ever made, but it's still appealing enough that you could play it for a group of five-year-olds and they would enjoy it. They would dance around to it. It's got this universal appeal to it. But when you listen to it, realize that there were a lot of people who were driven to the brink of insanity during the recording of this song, and Brian Wilson's reeling desire for perfection. So I want everyone to sit back. If you've heard this song before, great. I want you to turn it up and really try to hear it for the first time.
I love the colorful clothes you wear, and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. Somehow closer now. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. When I look in her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room.
I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations, she's giving me excitations.
Good vibration.
Unbelievable. The bass line, I think, Carole Kaye on bass doing that intricate, it's almost like Mozart-style bass line that is just, it's not holding down the groove at all. It's playing this weird run. The only, you know, again with the Beatles thing, the only bass playing like that you're ever going to hear on a rock record would have to be Paul McCartney and his unique style of bass playing. So we are winding down our Chasing Sound episode tonight. We appreciate you so much hanging out with us. We got one more song before we hand it over to Diamonds and Iron. We're actually guest hosting tonight for Diamonds and Iron, so if you're in the mood for some metal, hang out with us. That'll be coming down the pipe here in about 7 minutes. I want to remind everyone we have our spring membership drive coming up. That's going to be February 22nd through March 3rd. March 3rd is also my birthday, so if you remember, please send me a card. Please tune in during that. We're going to have some excellent programming. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. So check us out. I promise it won't be a drag. It's not going to just be begging for your help, though. There will be some of that. It's also going to be a lot of really good stuff. I know we'll everyone's going to pull out all the stops and do their best shows for that membership pledge drive. And we hope you are here hanging out with us and calling us and donating and telling us what shows you like and what you're into. That's coming down towards the end of February. Tonight we're going to end it with producer Butch Vig. Now, Butch Vig, kind of similar to some of the other great producers where he sort of set a tone and then suddenly everybody wanted a piece of him. So just to tell you, this guy went from being almost a nobody, a guy in a band, to producing. First he did the first Smashing Pumpkins album, which took a little while to hit, but it sounded great. And then shortly after that, the band Nirvana wanted him for Nevermind. Now, the record company, David Geffen Records, didn't want Nirvana to record Nevermind with this guy Butch Vig because he was an unknown commodity at that point. But Nirvana liked that. They still had this sort of punk crust to them. We're like, no, we want this guy, especially now that we know you don't want him. We really want him. And so they go in and make Nevermind at Sound City in California. And of course, that record sounds amazing. Whether or not that type of music is your cup of tea, it sounds so good. And after that, everybody wanted a piece of him. Everybody wanted to record at Sound City, and everybody wanted Butch Vig to produce. He went on to be in the band Garbage. He's the drummer and producer for that band, and he went on to produce a ton of interesting records. And it all sort of started with his doing, Smashing Pumpkins' Gish and Nirvana's Nevermind. Everybody just really wanted to use him after that. He showed his chops and his ability to capture a band at their best and really take them to the next level, basically. He did a lot for Nirvana, no doubt about it. He was the one that convinced Kurt Cobain to do double tracking on his vocals. He was the one that convinced Dave Grohl to play with a click track for the first time. He did a whole lot to move that band in an interesting direction. So one of my favorite songs off Nevermind is the album's closer, Something in the Way. And they were really struggling with this song. They couldn't get it right in the studio. So at some point, after like a bunch of false takes, Kurt Cobain walks into the control room, leaves the actual recording studio part, goes in where Butch is sitting behind the console, and Kurt Cobain lays down on a couch in there on his back with his acoustic guitar that had like a couple of broken strings on it and just says, it should sound like this. Like, I want it to sound like it's barely coming alive. And Kurt Cobain starts playing it and the guitar is out of tune and he's just barely whispering the vocals while he's laying down. So, you know, it sounds different when someone's singing while they're laying down. It sort of mutes the whole thing. And Butch Vig saw what he was doing. He was like, oh my God, this is it. And he runs and gets a couple of microphones and he's like, just lay there, dude. And he mics him up and he turns off all the fans, all the recording console fans and the preamp fans. He quiets everything down and he records him just like that. And they said it was just amazing. It sounded so good. But then they had to come in and add other layers to it, which was a real drag because his acoustic wasn't in tune. Yeah. So everybody else had to, there's cello in that song. So the cellist had to tune by ear to get as out of tune as he was. Bass player Chris had to tune his bass out of tune to just try to find where he was. And they were in the end, they ended up recording the overdubs one bar at a time because you had to stop and retune and make sure you were as out of tune as Kurt Cobain was. And it was this huge struggle, but the end result is gorgeous, and that's the song I'm going to play. I know it's weird to play something off of Nevermind and not have it be a rocker, but to me, we're highlighting the producers tonight, and this song shows you the genius of a guy that knew well enough to go grab a couple of microphones, forget about the normal, you know, basic studio setup for a minute, and try to capture something like a dude laying on a couch with an out-of-tune guitar. So here it is, Something in the Way from Nirvana. And this is going to be our last track for the night. Stay tuned for next week. And if you're into some metal tonight, hang out for Diamonds and Iron. We'll be hosting that as well. Good night.
From the ceiling, it's a